From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.
We will break the cycle of amnesty and illegal immigration. We will break the cycle.
Donald Trump's immigration plan.
We will end the sanctuary cities that have resulted in so many needless deaths.
Well, we've got half a dozen sanctuary cities here. He also talked about reforming the legal immigration system.
Do we take anybody? Come on in, anybody. Just come on in. Not anymore.
Well, Massachusetts has immigrants waiting in line, too. He also talked about refugees.
There's no documentation. There's no paperwork. It's going to end badly, folks. It's going to end very, very badly.
So much to discuss. We'll get reaction from across the board in Massachusetts to Trump's plan, plus talk with Senator Elizabeth Warren, next on Radio Boston. First, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Donald Trump gave his big immigration speech in Phoenix last night, vague about previous promises to deport 11 million undocumented immigrants, while also doubling down on his hard line about immigration into the U.S. as a whole. Trump cast the issue as the root cause of some of America's most serious challenges.
We are in the middle of a jobs crisis, a border crisis, and a terrorism crisis like never before. All energies of the federal government and the legislative process must now be focused on immigration security. That is the only conversation we should be having at this time. Immigration security. Cut it off.
Trump proposed a 10-point immigration plan last night on the southern border wall about illegal immigration and crime, deportation, visa overstays, immigrant vetting, limits on future legal immigration. And as we listened, we were struck by how many of these issues have an impact on Massachusetts. So today, we're going to do something a bit different. We're going to spend the entire hour getting local reaction to many of Donald Trump's proposals, and Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren will also be joining us later in the show. First, I want to provide some context, though, the straight numbers on immigration in Massachusetts. Here they are. Of the more than 6.6 million people who call this state home, a little more than 15%, just over a million, are foreign-born. Of those immigrants, more than half of them are naturalized U.S. citizens. Those are 2014 numbers from the U.S. Census Bureau. But much of Trump's speech focused on illegal immigration, and according to a 2014 report from the Pew Research Center, there were 150,000 undocumented immigrants in Massachusetts in 2012. That's down 17% from the estimated 180,000 in 2009. Which brings us to one of Donald Trump's proposals on how to control that illegal immigration. He proposed cracking down on so-called sanctuary cities. Those are cities whose policies protect undocumented immigrants from prosecution based solely on their immigration status. Here's number four in Trump's 10-point plan.
We will end the sanctuary cities that have resulted in so many needless deaths. Cities that refuse to cooperate with federal authorities will not receive taxpayer dollars, and we will work with Congress to pass legislation to protect those jurisdictions that do assist federal authorities.
Well, there are at least a half dozen sanctuary cities in Massachusetts, and joining us now are mayors of two of those cities, Lawrence Mayor Dan Rivera. Mayor Rivera, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much, Doug. Nice to be here.
Also with us from Cambridge is Mayor Denise Simmons. Mayor Simmons, welcome to you.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me to be on the program, and hello to my colleague, Mayor Rivera.
Well, first of all, Mayor Rivera, let me just start with you. What did you make of Donald Trump's singling out of sanctuary cities and saying that if cities refuse to cooperate with his administration, should he get elected, that there would be financial consequences?
Well, first and foremost, you know, we're not an official sanctuary city. We're a city that has an ordinance that basically says we're not going to do the federal government's job. And, you know, if he wants to create an unfounded mandate and deputize my police officers, he's going to have to pay for that. And that's the reality about immigration and even a lot of these large issues that are facing the country. They make it seem like it's, something that is really easy to solve, you know? Mm. And it's not. These are very complicated problems, and the issue of immigration is the same. So my guys, when they pull someone over and they're going through the process and the person has a taillight out or they ran a stoplight or something, we're not, we don't have the funding to keep those people, and ask them if they're here legally or not, or if they have the documents. We don't have the resources to do that. So
a practical, practical consideration there. Mayor Simmons, what's your view from Cambridge?
Well, I want to start by saying that Cambridge has been a city that long recognized, appreciated, and actually cultivated our sense of diversity. And Cambridge first designated itself as a sanctuary city in 1985, which was a response to the refugees fleeing the war-torn country of El Salvador. And it's a status that the city has recommitted itself into over the decades, and I'm glad that we've done so. It's also been our position and our trend are very similar to what Mayor Rivera says, is not to do other people's work, and that's why we continue to be a sanctuary city. I have to say, I'm very disheartened when I hear speeches like that from someone who wants to put their name in contention to hold the highest office of the land, where he tries to turn everyone into the other.
Mm. Well, Mayor Simmons, let me ask you. The reason why Donald Trump really singled out so-called sanctuary cities is it was in the larger context of the portion of his speech where he talked about illegal immigrants who had committed crimes and that he believed that sanctuary cities were sheltering these criminals. And that was why he wanted to crack down on them. And your reaction to that?
I don't agree. I take a very different position. Again, if I go, we turn us back to why Cambridge first became a sanctuary city. It was to very much, if you think of the Statue of Liberty that says, bring us your huddled masses, yearning to be free. It was really providing a safe place where families could live, grow, and thrive and not be traumatized by the rigors of war back at home.
All right. Well,
and
let me, if you might, I'm sorry. Yeah, I wanted to turn back to Mayor Rivera. Go ahead, Mayor Rivera.
And that was, and we're talking about refugees, we're talking about undocumented people that came from a war-torn country, from a war that we had a lot to do with. So, I applaud that they did that. But, again, it's like they broke the clock and then they're saying, hey, you're in trouble because you can't tell time. So, if they really want for that to happen, they have to fund and put a real serious policy into place. They don't have that. I think when you have those incidents where somebody who's undocumented creates a crime and they're not in custody, I think that shows how horribly the federal government is taking the serious issue, because frankly, if given more resources, we could take more bad people off the street.
Well, Mayor Rivera, let me ask you a quick question here, because if I remember correctly, Lawrence City Council voted last summer to become a sanctuary city through what was called the Trust Bill. But at that time, you opposed it. You didn't veto it, though. How do you feel about that now?
No, because I go back on this point. This is not, they didn't vote to become a sanctuary city. I think it polarizes the conversation in a way that's not useful for us. We have a lot of foreign-born people that live in our community, documented and undocumented. It's been our history that I guess since the turn of the century, first Irish and Polish and Italian, and now it just happens to be Dominicans and Guatemalans. So we don't do this is not a surprise. That you want to call, that people want to politicize what we do, which is we create an environment where, if the federal government was doing the work on the streets, I don't think we would get in the way of the federal government, but they're not.
Right. Denise Simmons, go ahead.
It's interesting how we talk about what they say illegal immigrants, and Mayor Rivera, the term I prefer, and you've used it a few times, undocumented individuals. But what is so very interesting to me is this country is a country of
immigrants.
Yeah. With the exception of the indigenous people who were here when this country was founded. I often say it wasn't lost, but that's another discussion. It's just interesting how we have this mean-spirited, I don't know how else to define it, attitude toward people who are doing no more or less than our forebears.
Hmm.
And honestly, can I just sit and follow up on that? And let's not forget, like, you know, some of the most important landmarks are built on the backs of immigrant workforces, and it's really who we are. But this is not only me; it's un-American that you would say a group of people that have come here from a different country, settling into our society, becoming part of our fabric, and they are the root of our problems. They're the reason why we have no jobs here. They're the reason why there's crime in our streets. They're the reason why our infrastructure is crying. That's not the case. I think the federal government has begun the process of getting out of the business of being a government.
Right.
That's why we have a lot of these problems. And so, again, I go back to this point. If you have a person who's running for office and they tell you they got an easy answer to a complicated problem, run the other way.
Well, that's...
Those people have no idea what they're talking about.
That's Dan Rivera. He's mayor of the city of Lawrence. Mayor Rivera, thank you so much for joining us today.
Anytime.
And Denise Simmons, mayor of the city of Cambridge. It was such a pleasure to speak with you. There's so much more to discuss, but thank you for joining us today.
The pleasure's been mine. Thank you for the opportunity.
We'll be back in just a minute to talk more about Donald Trump's immigration plan and its impact on Massachusetts. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We've got something of a different hour today. We're getting in-depth local reaction to Donald Trump's immigration speech last night and the reality of immigration in Massachusetts. Before the break, we talked about Trump's comments on so-called sanctuary cities, but he also talked a lot about illegal immigration and legal immigration. He hit rather hard on illegal immigration, proposing several reforms to how legal immigrants are admitted to the United States, including this one.
To choose immigrants based on merit, skill, and proficiency. Doesn't that sound nice? And to establish new immigration controls to boost wages and to ensure that open jobs are offered to American workers first, and that in particular African American and Latino workers who are being shut out in this process so unfairly.
So choosing immigrants based on merit, skill, and proficiency. Well, a major venture capital firm locally based says immigrants are vital to business creation. And in fact, they do not like what Donald Trump has been saying about immigration. And they have come up with their alternative plan. It's got an expletive in it that starts with F, and it's F Trump. The plan comes from Charles River Ventures, and they've announced that their firm will actually begin covering the costs for U.S. visas for any Charles River Venture Company founders. Joining us now from New York is an investor with Charles River, Danny Crichton. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So react to that bit of tape that we just played from Trump last night. It seems, at least on the face of it, there is some agreement. He wants to bring in immigrants based on merit, skill, and proficiency, and that would help the United States. What do you think?
Absolutely. You know, for decades, we've brought in immigrants from around the world to the United States on exactly those terms. The immigration system is complex, though. There are multiple programs. You know, a lot of our founders use technical visas like H-1Bs or O-1s to come over, but you know, there are also families and other visa programs to help bring everyone here who wants to come.
Okay, so tell me then about why not that long ago Charles River Ventures went out, it seems, on a limb in terms of political actions that businesses or VC companies take, and actually created this plan whose title is F Trump.
You know, we're a 46-year-old venture firm originally founded in Boston, and when you look at our portfolio over those 46 years, a majority of our founders were immigrants. In addition, among the nine partners, seven of them are immigrants, and we speak eight languages. And so for us, it wasn't just a question of politics. In fact, it was not a question of politics at all. It was really an existential risk to our firm that we really need immigration from around the world to continue to build businesses, to continue to create jobs in America. Obviously, we do get a return from that, but it helps everyone in the economy.
But you have to admit, though, that CRV made it somewhat political with its choice of the title for its new project.
Absolutely, and I think that the title was absolutely in line with sort of our feelings about it. I mean, for seven out of nine of us, these sorts of words, Trump's tones for the last 2 years, has really influenced not just how they perceive the United States, but how many of their founders do as well. I mean, we're constantly in communication with our founders, many of whom are immigrants, as I said, and you know they're feeling this pressure every single day that they are not wanted here, that they are not supposed to be building their companies here. And they're looking around and saying, look, I made 500 jobs here. Like, I've done more than Donald Trump. Like, why is this up for debate? And so I felt that we really express what a lot of founders and venture capitalists are saying behind the scenes publicly.
Hmm. Well, Danny Crichton, tell me a little bit more about why it seems, I mean, you think that that a Trump presidency, what kind of impact it could have on venture capitalists or the venture capital community?
I mean, it really depends on what happens. We don't really know what Trump's actual policy positions are. So, and they seem to change quite radically all the time. So, you know, if you look at what he said last night, you know, we do admit today based on merit. If you looked at the White House's proposal just last week to bring in additional founders, any founder who owns more than 15% of their business and has received $345,000 of venture capital from U.S.-based domestic venture capitalists, would be given special preference as part of the visa process. So I think we've already seen these sorts of policies, and it's unfortunate that what has been, I think, a bipartisan coalition of politicians for the last probably 50 years around merit and around bringing in the best engineers and the best scientists from around the world to the United States has really come under attack in the last 18 months.
Now, I note that more than 145 tech executives, entrepreneurs, and venture capitalists did sign a letter in July of this year, so just last month, saying a Trump presidency would, quote, be a disaster for innovation. But on the other hand, one of the nation's most famous investors, Peter Thiel, spoke at the Republican National Convention, you know, saying that that he believes that the Republican Party could bring about leadership that would spur great, you know, Manhattan project-sized innovation in the future.
You know, it's really fascinating on Peter Thiel. You know, one of his most famous founders is Elon Musk of SpaceX, who comes from South Africa. If you look at his own portfolio, many, many of his companies come from overseas to the United States to build the future. And so I think what you're seeing here is that Silicon Valley does have a diversity of views. And everyone is allowed to hold their own opinion. I think the difference between the July letter and what CRV was trying to do is saying it's not just a question of individual preferences, that it's actually a business imperative that we continue to support the best entrepreneurs from around the world coming to the United States.
What about
that was sort of the difference?
I can imagine that if a rebuttal from Donald Trump himself would be, but the best entrepreneurs are right here within the United States already, and they're the ones who deserve the support and funding of companies like Charles River Ventures.
And they're right. I mean, look, a majority of our founders are immigrants, and obviously the other half are not. So I think from our perspective, we always want to support the best entrepreneurs, the best companies, because those are the ones that develop and create the most jobs, that create the most impact, that create the future, essentially. And so from our perspective, we think of it as a purely meritocratic function. We want to focus on the absolute best, the number one entrepreneur who's going to create that Facebook, that Airbnb, that Uber, that Udacity. And the only way we're going to do that is to ensure that all the best people, whether they're local here or people who want to be local, have the ability to do that and have access to the capital markets that the United States offers.
Well, Danny Crichton is an investor with Charles River Ventures. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
As I said, we're getting reaction from across Massachusetts to Donald Trump's immigration speech and his 10-point plan that he presented last night. Would love to hear from you. If you've got some thoughts, call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Okay, so Danny Crichton walked us through at least one venture capitalist view of Trump's immigration plan. Let's swing to possibly the other end of the extreme, and that, or the other end of the spectrum, and that is to the topic of refugees, which was mentioned in part six, or number six, of Donald Trump's 10-point plan.
For the price of resettling one refugee in the United States, 12 could be resettled in a safe zone in their home region, which I agree with 100%. We have to build safe zones, and we'll get the money from the Gulf states.
Well, joining us now in the studio is Sasha Chanoff. He's the founder and executive director of Refugee Point, a refugee advocacy organization. He's also co-author of the book From Crisis to Calling, Finding Your Moral Center in the Toughest Decisions. Sasha Chanoff, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Magna, nice to be here.
Okay, so give us your reaction to Donald Trump's discussion or how he discussed refugees in terms of his immigration plan last night.
Well, so the U.S. refugee program essentially handpicks people who are in life-threatening situations and cannot go or be anywhere else safely. And we have extreme vetting measures already in place to identify and enable refugees to come here. I have two points that I think I'd like to make with you. One is the nature of the vetting process, which takes a number of years. And the second one is actually the economic contributions of refugees, following on Danny Crichton's point. And perhaps it's worth starting there.
Okay. Well, let's do that. I mean, give me your quick thought on that.
Yeah, the quick thought is that we see that Mayor Denise Simmons talked about bring me your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. We find that those refugees who actually come here become innovators, contribute to society, and are entrepreneurs. If you look at Lewiston, Maine, if you look at St. Louis, Missouri, if you look at Utica, New York, and many other cities, you see that refugees have actually helped to regenerate depressed areas of these cities, that they start businesses, that they actually bring business and economic benefits to cities.
Okay.
So that's one important point, I think, to make.
Well, I want to touch on your second point as well. But, I mean, you did mention the extreme vetting, because that is specifically the context in which Donald Trump talked about refugees last night. And I want to play another clip from his speech, because, I mean, he said, and he quoted himself essentially last night, saying that he thinks that refugees are, quote unquote, the Trojan horse when it comes to holes in American immigration and immigration security. So here he is speaking a little bit more about that, specifically regarding refugees from Syria.
And we are going to stop the tens of thousands of people coming in from Syria. We have no idea who they are, where they come from. There's no documentation. There's no paperwork. It's going to end badly, folks. It's going to end very, very badly.
Sasha, you said that that refugees undergo extreme vetting already. That's completely the opposite of what Trump is saying.
In fact, Magna, I wrote an op-ed for the Boston Globe that highlighted this, and it highlights the extreme vetting nature of our program. Here's essentially what happens. I know this because the organization Refuge Point that I lead works across the world to identify refugees for resettlement. We spend a lot of time with them, a year, 2 years or longer, visiting them where they live. We know what they eat, what they wear, who their friends are. And when we visit them and we find that they are people who are in life-threatening situations, who can't go anywhere else, then we submit them for consideration for resettlement. We've gotten to know them more than I know my neighbors in Somerville, where I live. After that, the U.S. government affiliate officers come in, and 2 to 3 to 4 people interview refugees over a period of time to cross-examine them and interview them on this process. After that, specially trained Department of Homeland Security Refugee Corps officers who know country conditions and know and are specially trained in fraud issues come in and interview refugees as well. After that whole process, then if that officer approves them for resettlement, they then go through a series of extensive vetting measures with the FBI, the CIA, the Department of Homeland Security, and then they go through medical exams. It takes a couple of years, and through this process, if any new information comes to light, then their whole resettlement could be stopped.
And how long does this all take?
On average, about 2 years, and we can actually accelerate that process and still maintain the same security measures as we have. The refugee program is not the place where terrorists are going to come in. Nobody would try to get in when they are undergoing a process that's fraught with uncertainty every step of the way. Conflating refugees with terrorism is fear-mongering, it's wrong, and it's egregious when you think about the fact that these are people who have survived the worst atrocities and want to survive and rebuild their lives.
Okay, so what about Trump's idea then of creating safe zones in Syria specifically? That, you know, it seems as if he was saying the United States wouldn't have to take any refugees if, in his words, as we talked about earlier, he gets the Gulf states to actually do that and pay for the creation of a safe zone in Syria.
Yeah, sure. So that's an idea that's been explored in different places. In Somalia, for example, which has produced many over 1 million refugees refugees over the past decades. It's been explored to create safe zones where refugees can go back. It hasn't worked. The U.S. government actually provides hundreds of millions and more dollars to protect refugees overseas and help them to stabilize their lives there. But for those people who cannot survive safely where they are, people like that boy, the 5-year-old boy who survived that bombing in Aleppo and his video went viral, people who are injured, people who are being, because of their human rights activities, are being sought after by terrorists, these are people who access our refugee resettlement program. They can't go anywhere else safely. It's for the small, hand-picked few, even though it's tens of thousands, there are 65 million people in the world who've been displaced by conflict. We find those people who need this as a life-saving measure, and it actually helps to bolster who we are. It contributes to our ethos as Americans of people who believe in justice, equality, and concern for the oppressed across the world.
So in the Massachusetts Office for Refugees and Immigrants, they have a number. In 2015, about 1,900 refugees were resettled and assisted here in Massachusetts. Can you just tell us a little bit more specifically about, you know, what are the kind of supports or the costs? Because again, it's the issue of both security and cost and the insinuation that resources are going towards refugees that Donald Trump is making that maybe should be going towards other people.
Yeah, when I was on your show before, people highlighted the costs of refugee resettlement. Certainly there are costs, but what we see over the long run and what studies have shown is that refugees contribute more economically than they take. That in the short run, up front, they need an investment to help them stabilize. There are organizations here in the U.S. that, and I worked for them before I started Refuge Point, that enable refugees to integrate here. But once they get on their own feet, they start working, they start businesses, they contribute more than they actually take. And again, they contribute to our ethos of hard work and resilience and striving that I think is essential to the American character.
Sasha, hang on here for just a second. I want to take a quick call. Alex is calling from Medford. You're on the air, Alex.
Hi, I just wanted
Birmingham.
Alex from Medford, are you with us?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm a very middle ground kind of person, and when he says that for the cost of one person resettled, we could save 12 in a local safe zone, you know, I say why not strive for better and get all 13 of them, resettle that one person, and try to get those 12 people out of harm's way. And, you know, don't take funds out of resettling people to save them. You know, that doesn't make sense. Put together a humanitarian effort that can, you know, draw in a coalition of all sorts of countries and get those safe zones and resettle people. Why does it always have to be one or the other?
Alex, great thought. Let me turn it back to Sasha. Sasha, your thoughts?
I'm on the front lines of this work every day and have worked across the world doing refugee assistance and protection. So it is important to find safe zones. In fact, refugee camps have often been those safe zones. People flee from the country where there's war to a neighboring country and they're received in refugee camps. We have not succeeded in creating safe zones in countries that are at war. I mean, it's an interesting idea, but it's not something that I think is borne out in examples anywhere. We do want to try to find ways for refugees to become self-reliant in the countries to which they fled, and that's something that we're working on and that the global community is thinking about and that President Obama will highlight in his refugee summit in a few weeks. But for those, again, who can't stay safely where they are, resettlement is the only option and it's life-saving.
Well, Sasha Chanoff is the founder and executive director of Refuge Point, a refugee advocacy organization. He's also co-author of From Crisis to Calling, Finding Your Moral Center in the Toughest Decisions. Sasha Chanoff, thank you so much.
Thanks, Magna.
We're talking about Donald Trump's immigration speech last night. We're going to take your calls at 1-800-423-8255. We'll be back, and when we come back after this break, Senator Elizabeth Warren. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We've been spending most of this hour talking about Donald Trump's big speech on immigration last night and its ramifications, here in Massachusetts. But I want to just take a step aside here for a moment because we are joined now by a formidable foe of Mr. Trump, U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren. Senator Warren, it's such a pleasure to welcome you to Radio Boston. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Now, I know we want to talk about some of the issues near and dear to your heart of late, including drug prices and the price of private colleges, which we will in a second. But since we've been talking so much on immigration, I was just wondering if I could get your reaction to Mr. Trump's speech last night.
You know, my sense is it doesn't change anything. Donald Trump launched his campaign as an attack on anybody who didn't look pretty much just like Donald Trump. And he started it with immigrants, although he was quick to expand it to anybody who had a different religion. He was quick to include, you know, attacks on women and others. And he's pretty much locked himself in that position. And, you know, he may twist and turn here and there, and he may try to dress it up with a move to trip down to Mexico. But the bottom line is he's trying to run a presidential campaign on turning us against each other and not on the kind of issues that I think we need to be talking about how we build a country going forward, one that works not just for the Donald Trumps of the world, but one that works for all of us.
You know, it's interesting because Donald Trump said frequently last night that one of the reasons why he believes some serious controls need to be put on immigration, both legal and illegal, is to protect American workers. And you have, you know, you've based your entire career on advocating for American workers as well. So both of you caring about similar things, but coming at it from very different perspectives.
Yeah, well, you know, one way that we can protect American workers is to bring people out of the shadows who are already here in the United States and to get them into minimum wage jobs, to make sure that they can pay taxes, to make sure that they all have the same rights. I talked to construction workers here in Massachusetts who talked to me about what it means that, you know, at some construction site down the way, they're hiring people who don't have any legal rights, and as a result, they don't pay them part of the time, or they pay them, you know, $5 an hour. They don't have the ordinary safety features. It's pretty darn hard for our folks to compete against that. But the question is, then how do you fix it? What do you do about that? And I think what you do about that is you find a way to bring people in out of the shadows, to make sure that they are part of this economy and that the same set of rules apply to everyone. I think that's how we build more strength for working people in this country.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about some of the other significant pressures on people that you've been very vocal about recently. You were among 20 senators who sent a letter to the pharmaceutical company Mylan this week, calling their offer of a generic version of the EpiPen, a $300 generic version, an industry tactic. Tell us why the $300 generic wasn't good enough for you.
Well, let's keep in mind, I mean, look, if they had said, I tell you what, we're going to bring out the EpiPen now at $1,200, and then everybody said, no, not that. And they said, okay, we'll go back to just $600. Would you be feeling okay about that? I wouldn't be, because what they've really been doing is running these prices up on something that, you know, it doesn't bear at all on what their costs of production are here. This is a long-established product. You know, the science has been well-known for a long time. There's nothing new going on here. They've just figured out they can jack up the price, and because people need it, because, you know, this is one of those things that could be life-saving, they're willing to pay.
And Senator Warren, do you mind if I ask? I mean, it seems as if one of the things that allows this to happen is that, to be blunt about it, it's what the market can bear.
Well, but that raises the fundamental question, doesn't it, about whether or not markets for life-saving drugs are really functional, competitive markets. I mean, look, this is a drug now that there could be multiple people producing generic versions of it. And if they did, the price wouldn't be $600, the price wouldn't be $300, it'd be a lot lower than that. But what some of these pharmaceutical companies have figured out are ways to get in, slow up the process on getting generics brought to market. Some of the pharmaceutical companies actually buy up the generic manufacturers to keep generics off the market. In other words, find every way that they can to manipulate markets so that they can maximize their own profits. I mean, look at the latest version of this that the EpiPen has also offered. Not only have they offered this generic version, which you really have to say. So explain to me how that's going to work. Are you going to offer a $600 version and a $300 version to the same people at exactly the same moment? Are you going to take the $600 version off the market? I mean, I think there are a lot of questions here. But this business, too, where they say, well, what we're going to do is we're going to give a $100 rebate or a $200 rebate.
Yeah.
To the customer, you know, you've heard about this one. And there are a bunch of drug companies that have really high-priced drugs that have tried this. And this is just a shell game that's going on.
Well, exactly. And I'm going to jump in here because I think you're getting to the question that I wanted to ask.
Sure.
Because until there's some kind of major reform, I mean, isn't this sort of like you're going to just be playing whack-a-mole with, you know, one drug company after another and their potential life-saving drugs? I mean, if the market's going to shift, doesn't it need, isn't it the role of the federal government? I'm thinking about Canada, right? The price of the EpiPen didn't change in Canada because the federal government negotiates with the companies.
Yep. Yep. So look, we can do the small adjustments. You're exactly right. For example, this business of using the idea of a rebate here, because all that really does is take the $600 EpiPen, pushes the price down to $500, and the insurance company has to pick up the whole ticket, which means ultimately, of course, the people who buy insurance have to pick up the ticket, or the government has to pick up the whole ticket. In fact, this whole business of doing these rebates so distorts the market that Medicare and Medicaid make it illegal to do rebates back for paying the customer's portion of the price of the bill. And you're right. It is a bit of a whack-a-mole game. You know, you try to fix this particular problem they're dealing with. You try to find a little broader approach by saying, how can we get generics to market more quickly? But we are rapidly approaching the day when we really have to ask, what is the relationship here between people who need the drugs and the drug manufacturers and the federal government that is supposed to represent the patients, represent the people?
Well, so what's your answer to that? What should the relationship be?
Well, right now it can't be that the drug companies can get out there and set any price, play any game, distort any market in any way they want, and just keep scooping up the money by the double handfuls. That simply cannot be the answer. And it can't be the answer for two reasons. One is because we just can't sustain it. We cannot afford it over a long arc. And two is because it's just wrong. They should not be able to hold up Americans who need those life-saving drugs, who helped develop those through our contributions to the National Institutes of Health and the National Science Foundation, and to walk away with literally billions of dollars in profits off those products when nobody else around the world is paying that kind of money for their drugs. Not right.
Well, Senator Warren, it is September 1st here, so I want to ask you about education, because I know you've been speaking very passionately about for-profit colleges for a while now. And just last week, the Obama administration banned the ITT Technical Institute, one of the largest for-profit college chains in the U.S., from enrolling new students who are getting federal aid. I was going to ask you for your reaction to that, but also what I really want to know is, isn't the federal government part of the problem here because it does give out so much aid to students who then use it to enroll in for-profit colleges?
Okay, so let me just start. Let's do a little background on this. Okay, we'll do 101 on for-profit colleges. Right now, remember these three numbers, 10, 20, 40. 10% of all people enrolled in colleges are enrolled not in a state school, not in a private university, but in a for-profit college. You know, the kind you see advertised on television or in the subways. They are getting 20% of all the federal student loan dollars and Pell Grants, and they are responsible for 40% of all of the defaults on student loans. In other words, there is a whole multi-billion-dollar industry out there that has been built off federal loan dollars to people who are just trying to get a foot in the door to get an education to improve their circumstances in life. And some of these colleges, like ITT, have been investigated in their case by more than 20 government agencies, including attorneys general around the country. Maura Healey, our own attorney general, is suing them for fraud because they make all kinds of promises to these young people. Many of these colleges, by the way, spend more money on advertising than they do on their entire educational program. And they get these people to sign on the dotted line for these so-called educational programs. And then they're stuck with all of this student loan debt that whether they can get a job or not,
right,
they've got to repay. They can't discharge those debts in bankruptcy. And the for-profit college keeps making money and handing out dividends to its investors. And finally, with ITT, after all the investigations, after all the trouble that it's in, the Department of Education just said, enough is enough. You are not going to get any more federal dollars to enroll any more students in your programs until you clean up your act.
Should the government be doing that with more of them, or should it just actually help solve the problem by turning the spigot off?
Well, that's effectively what it's doing here. It's saying you can't get any new dollars in order to bring more students in. We're not going to help you sell any more tickets on the Titanic here. I mean, that's basically what the government is saying. And yes, this represents a real shift for the Department of Education, and I think exactly the right kind of shift. The Department of Education is basically saying it is not our job to try to help for-profit colleges make more profits. It's our job to try to help students who are trying to get an education, and frankly, to try to protect the taxpayers so they don't get stuck on bad student loan debts because these young people sign on the dotted line, don't get an education, and then can't get a job to pay it back.
Are you worried that coming down too hard, though, on some of the for-profit institutions could actually harm, you know, a lot of non-traditional students, people with full-time jobs, parents, folks looking for specialized kinds of skill sets that they can only get through these for-profit institutions, that you could actually inadvertently end up harming them?
Look, there's no doubt that there are some for-profit institutions that are providing real value to the people who sign up with them. But there is also no doubt that there are a lot of these for-profit institutions that are in it for the money. Like I said, spending more on advertising than they're spending on the overall educational program. And the real question is to say, look, the Department of Education is going to start squeezing those that are accused and have been found guilty of fraud and misrepresentation and not helping their students. I think that is exactly the right thing for the Department of Education to do. And by the way, I just want to put in one other pitch. We got to remember, we also have a lot of really terrific other educational opportunities. A lot of our community colleges, particularly here in Massachusetts, are just doing a terrific job at offering classes virtually around the clock. I remember being over at Bunker Hill and learning that I think they start at 7 in the morning. I was talking to the president of Bunker Hill, and she said they run until 2 a.m.
Yeah.
trying to be there for their students. I was just meeting with the president of Roxbury Community College, and she was telling me about all the new and innovative programs they're trying to offer. They're working with employers to make sure that they have the kinds of programs that employers are providing, the skills that employers want to see. You know, there's a lot of this work. I was just out at Berkshire County Community College on Saturday and meeting with the president out there, and we were talking about their programs. There are just terrific programs going on here in Massachusetts, and the cost is so much lower than it is at these for-profit colleges.
Right. Well, Senator Warren, I got to jump in here because I know that my time is really limited with you, and I do want to ask you one more question because I have to. I'd like to actually loop it right back to Donald Trump because the rest of our show is going to be talking about Mr. Trump. You know, you gave a commencement speech at the very beginning of the summer where you had told the students that did you ever imagine that you'd end up in a Twitter war with Donald Trump? No, but that's where you've ended up. I'm just wondering, how's that war going on from your perspective?
You know, my sense is that a lot more people today are paying attention to Donald Trump in a serious way, not just, you know, he's a showman. He's, you know, look at the funny thing Donald Trump has just done. But really kind of trying on the glass slipper to see if Donald Trump really would fit. And the answer is, oh, my gosh, not at all. Donald Trump seems to get up every day and look for one more way to prove that he is not qualified to be president of the United States. And I think we have to use every possible way to call him out on that. And, yeah, that includes Twitter. It includes interviews. It includes op-eds. It includes talking to the guy standing behind you in line at the grocery store. This is a really serious issue for our country, for our future, for our whole identity of who we are and what kind of a nation we want to build going forward. It cannot be Donald Trump's vision of this world. And I think that means it is the responsibility of all of us to speak up loudly and clearly. I'm going to keep doing it, and I hope everyone else is too.
Well, that's Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. It's been such a pleasure to speak with you, Senator Warren. I look forward to having you back in our studio next time.
You bet.
All right. Thanks so much.
Well,
let's get back to talking about Donald Trump's immigration speech last night more specifically. And I want to welcome into the conversation Rachel Kemp. She's an investment banker from Dorchester and the only person of color on the Republican State Committee. Rachel Kemp, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much. I'd like to make one clarification before we go forward. Not an investment banker yet. I don't have my Series 79, so I am technically a representative agent. So just a little clarification.
No, the details matter and point well taken. Thank you very much. I mean, what would your parents were immigrants. Donald Trump's speech last night was all 100% about immigration. What was your reaction to what you heard?
Well, what I heard, and this is where Americans really need an education on immigration policy, is that he's hearkening back to 1954 when we had Operation Wetback, where there were mass deportations, but it also was a call to use the laws that we currently have on our books. And unfortunately, you know, the whole immigration crisis has gone on too long where there are families, there are children that are involved, but American immigration law has zero tolerance for people who are here illegally.
Mm.
And under the Obama administration, we've had the luxury, so to speak, of having policy discretion where we've been able to say there are exemptions to deportation policies. And that is what is happening today.
What do you make of the fact that yesterday it seems as if we heard from two different types of Donald Trump? One version in Mexico when he was visiting with the president of Mexico, and the other last night in Phoenix. Is what he said last night going to alleviate the concerns or the discomfort that some Republicans have with him, or that some independent voters who may not know exactly who they want to vote for, but they feel their concerns? I mean, do you think he said anything to alleviate that or only heighten those concerns?
Well, he's the conversation in Phoenix was Donald Trump. I mean, he said he has stuck to his policies, very little change from his previous statements to what he said last night. When he was in Mexico, that was an opportunity for him to demonstrate that he did have the ability to be statesmanlike, to be a diplomat, to stand on the largest international stage. So he was, in one breath, he was taking a little bit of the argument away from Hillary Clinton's campaign, where they're saying that he doesn't understand how to be a statesman. He tried to demonstrate that last night. But then when he was in Phoenix, he was speaking to the American public. He was speaking to people who have real concerns. And it actually was his first very clear public policy statement.
Did any aspect of his speech, even though he didn't, I mean, he'd made overtures to, once again, to African-Americans and Latino voters, saying that he believes his version of immigration reform would actually assist them in terms of jobs and other government benefits, not other government benefits, but protecting benefits for Americans. But other folks reacted to the speech as a whole, saying even though he didn't outwardly express any racist views, they still found it to be racist.
Well, I believe that Mr. Trump has a very limited understanding of the community of color. When it comes to the community of color, their core values are so much like what we as Republicans believe that freeing up or allegedly or potentially freeing up social services because you've deported people is not going to have a significant or material impact on anyone's life.
I'm going to have to stop you there, Rachel Kemp of the Republican State Committee of Massachusetts. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.